In rural India, a third of the government seats are reserved for women, and women have different priorities than men.
When she first came to power, she introduced latrines into every single house in the village by negotiating a massive discount with a toilet provider.
In Afghanistan, women are influencing society too, but through a new TV show called Afghan Model. It's not as radical as you might think.
I think wearing a headscarf on stage should be okay. It doesn't cover the whole face.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
How's your wife?
And in Mali, there's a fine art to saying hi to your neighbor.
I'm fine.
How are your children?
Fine.
How's your husband?
Fine.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymeyer. First, this hour's news.
Well, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, have a nice day.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Immigration reform is on the agenda in Washington this week. While politicians debate the issue, four undocumented high school graduates are about to arrive in the nation's capital on foot. They've been walking since January 1st in support of the DREAM Act. That's a bill that would give high school graduates, who are children of illegal immigrants, a chance to become citizens. As they walk, the so-called Dreamers are sharing their stories and responding to their critics. Sandy Houseman caught up with them near Richmond, Virginia.
On a warm weekday morning, four young people stroll down Jefferson Davis Highway, past cheap motels, offices, and convenience stores. They stop to rest outside JD's supermarket, where a sign in Spanish offers Latin American foods, bill paying, and check cashing services. One of them, Gabby Pacheco, sits cross-legged on the sidewalk talking with a radio station back home in Miami about the 1,500-mile trek she's taking with three friends from community college. For nearly 4 months, they've walked about 17 miles a day in rain and even snow, enduring blistered feet and too little sleep to drum up support for the DREAM Act. That's the bill that would allow thousands of undocumented immigrants a chance at higher education and eventually full citizenship. One of the four making the journey, Felipe Matos, wants to teach. Now 24, he came here illegally a decade ago to live with relatives because his Brazilian mother was too sick to care for him. He excelled at school, graduating at the top of his community college class and serving as student body president.
I applied to finish my bachelor's degree because I wanted to become a biology teacher, and I got accepted to many schools, pretty much every single state university in Florida, and they're all the honors programs, but I had to pay the out-of-state fee, which is four times as much as everybody else back in Florida. I'm not allowed to get any financial aid. I'm not allowed to get any type of loans. And to top it off, I'm not even allowed to work legally. So how was I supposed to pay $30,000, $40,000 yearly, plus, you know, living expenses? It was impossible.
But higher education would be possible for Matos if Congress approves the DREAM Act, a measure that enjoys bipartisan support. Under the act, people who came to this country before the age of 16, have lived here continuously for at least 5 years, and have no criminal record, would be eligible for permanent residency if they enlist in the military or enroll in college. Those who qualify for the program would be able to get student loans and other financial aid. Inside the old RV that's accompanied them on their walk to Washington, the Dreamers, as they call themselves, have plugged in their cell phones and Blackberries, cameras and computers. They're sharing the trip with thousands through Twitter and uploading video of their adventures. In Georgia, for example, they watched from behind police barricades as the Ku Klux Klan staged an anti-immigration rally.
They're here for one reason, the American dollar, so they could take our money back to Mexico. But we don't want them to take our money back.
20-year-old Juan Rodriguez was discouraged by that kind of talk. His family left Colombia when he was six. At the time, kidnappings for ransom were rampant, and middle-class people, like the Rodriguez family, were prime targets. In the United States, Juan excelled at school and hoped to attend college. Since he couldn't get financial aid, that was out of reach. So he decided to hit the road, or what he and his friends have dubbed the Trail of Dreams.
We were talking about kind of recreating the Underground Railroad. We wanted youth to be able to travel from one city to another and be guided by a community that supported them and understood their struggle to take them all the way to D.C. where the decisions of this country are made.
Along the way, local groups have welcomed them, providing free food and a place to stay at night. But in Washington, a group called the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR, is working against the DREAM Act.
It really does nothing to secure our borders, make us safer. It undermines the rule of law, and it simply creates further incentive for more unlawful entry and illegal presence.
Bob Dane is a spokesman for the group. He opposes any kind of amnesty for undocumented immigrants, including students who came here with their parents.
It's fundamentally unfair to those who come here and have played by the rules.
DREAM Act supporters say undocumented kids who've grown up here are being punished for what their parents did. But Dane disagrees.
I don't think we're punishing the children for what their parents have done. We're simply not rewarding them. Regardless of legal status, every child in the United States, by way of Supreme Court decision, is entitled already to a K-12 education. So we've already been subsidizing illegal alien students, and frankly, we don't think we have anything to apologize for.
He adds that U.S. citizens suffer when undocumented students are admitted to public universities at in-state rates. 10 states now do that, among them California.
You've got 10,700 legal U.S. residents on waiting list to get into the University of California system. Yet, at the same time, the University of California system is admitting illegal alien students into college with in-state tuition. Fundamentally unfair.
DREAM Act backers say it's fundamentally unfair to deny them opportunities, and they're hoping Congress agrees. A vote could come this spring or after midterm elections in the fall. Meanwhile, the Dreamers keep telling their stories to anyone who will listen, risking arrest in some cases by speaking openly with police they meet along the way. The group says one conversation actually persuaded a deputy sheriff, and Gabby believes others will change their minds.
Only through our stories have people really had a change of heart, because they've been able to understand the complexities of the broken immigration system that we have in this country.
This weekend, Gabby and her friends will join with another team who have been walking to D.C. from New York City. Both groups will participate in a rally near the White House in support of the DREAM Act. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sandy Houseman in Richmond, Virginia.
Politicians in Washington are thinking about how their immigration votes will play out in elections later this year. Across the ocean in the U.K., the national elections are just around the corner. May 6th, in fact. But this time, it's not just the English who will vote for the next government. Citizens of Afghanistan, Ghana, and Bangladesh will also get a chance to vote in British elections. Here's how it works. Someone in the UK volunteers to give up their vote to someone overseas.
People in the UK can go to the website, which is giveyourvote.org, and submit their phone number and pledge to represent the vote of somebody in one of these countries.
That's May Abdallah. She's one of the organizers of the campaign called Give Your Vote.
They can also choose to team up with a vote buddy, somebody in Afghanistan, Bangladesh, or Ghana who has access to the internet, who they can be in direct communication with, discuss what are the issues that are affecting them and how they want to vote.
And then, on election day,
what will happen is that people in these countries are able to text their vote to somebody in the UK who can carry out that vote for them.
The goal of the campaign is to highlight the fact that decisions made in England can impact millions of people in other countries.
What we wanted to focus on was campaigning for people to have an equal say in the decisions that affect them, and a decision-making process that reflected our global world, the world where, you know, our environment is connected, our economies are connected, our politics are connected, but our participation in those decisions are fragmented.
So voters in Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Ghana can now literally have an influence, albeit small, in British elections. Why those three countries? Because they're all directly affected by decisions made in the UK. There's the war in Afghanistan, climate change affecting Bangladesh, and trade decisions that have an impact on farmers in Ghana. To get the word out, the Give Your Vote campaign has launched parallel election campaigns in all three of those countries. In Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Ghana, you'll find radio and print ads about the British campaign and subtitled broadcasts of British political debates. Even though just a fraction of the English have given up their votes, Thousands of people, both in the UK and overseas, have expressed interest.
Here's a quote from Kojo, who's a community worker in Accra, and he said, instead of always being on the receiving end of decisions, I want to take my own voice to the UK politicians that affect my country. And I'm very thankful for the British people for this. And from Reza in Kabul, he said, I voted in the Afghan elections because I believe in democracy. But when did I elect the people who are making decisions about my country from London? Give your vote is a chance for me to make my voice heard.
And what are British people saying?
Voters in the UK, this is a quote from Finley, who's a 19-year-old in the south of England. And he says, I feel like this is a very powerful thing to do with my vote. And it means a lot to be able to do this.
The politicians in England have been paying attention, too. They've been getting questions from people around the world via their voting buddies.
No politician is going to dismiss somebody who's holding a vote. And that changes the dynamic radically between somebody in Afghanistan and a politician in London when that politician in London needs to respond to that person's questions because someone in the UK says, that's where my vote is going.
Of course, there are plenty of critics. It's a provocative idea to allow people who aren't citizens to vote for a country's leaders. And really, citizens of Afghanistan, Ghana, and Bangladesh aren't affected by most of the British government's decisions. But May Abdallah says that's not really the point.
The aim of this campaign is not to change the outcome of the election. It's to make a significant statement, and it's to make people think and challenge the ideas that we have at the moment about how people participate in the decisions that affect them.
That was May Abdallah, one of the organizers of the Give Your Vote campaign. Some Afghanis might be listening to the British election campaign on their favorite radio station. Others are listening to this. That's Haseeb Habib, a popular Afghan singer, performing Layla. Women in India could soon have one-third of all parliamentary seats reserved for them. The quota system is already in place in rural areas.
The most dramatic difference that it's making is that women have been found to spend the money that's directed to them by local and state governments on amenities that matter to women. And the main one is water wells. So if you have a female village leader, she's more likely to provide access to drinking water.
More on that story after a short break. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The Upper House of Parliament in India recently agreed to a quota system for women in government. That means a third of all parliamentary seats will be reserved for women. The lower house still has to vote on the bill, but that support is likely. The need for this ruling might seem strange in a country with such prominent women leaders as Indira and Sonia Gandhi. But in India's patriarchal society, most women in power are there because they're connected to powerful men. That's also true in rural areas, where the quota system for women has been in place for more than 17 years. Mian Ridge is a freelance reporter based in Delhi.
Basically, India is governed at a local level by panchayats, which are village-level sort of committees, and they're made up of between sort of 8 and 12 people deciding on the size of the village. Since 1993, a third of the chief positions, which means the sort of head of the village, have been reserved for women, and then a third of the seats in the panchayats themselves, so a third of the sort of people who govern underneath that chief. So when the chief position comes up in those places, only a woman will be able to stand. So you'll have women standing against each other in some cases.
It's interesting that they've done it at a local level but haven't done it on a national level.
In a way, it's needed more at the local level, in a sense, because villages are more patriarchal than urban areas in India. So in some of these villages where there are women chiefs now, say 20 years ago, women would barely have been involved in public life at all. They wouldn't have left the house even very often in some places. So in some ways, it was needed more. In others, it's appealing to do it in villages first because the panchayats have a very limited powers still. They basically distribute funds from state and central governments, and they oversee policies directed by higher governments. So they don't have as much power as, obviously, as parliamentarians.
Obviously, India is an enormous country, and in some places it might work better than others. Some of the opposition on the national level was because it doesn't work in some ways on the local level. How is it not working? And then we can talk about how it is working.
There's been an awful lot of academic research into how successful reservations have been at the village level. And it's been found that in some cases, women have indeed become political proxies for their husbands. And in some of my reporting in Haryana, which is the state next to Delhi, I found that that was certainly the case.
Can you describe a situation to us?
Yeah, in one village I was trying to find the sarpanch, which is the village chief, who is a woman who'd come to power through on a reserved seat. And everyone I spoke to, I couldn't find her herself. She was away working or looking after her children. She was unavailable. But everyone I spoke to said that she was the political proxy of her husband, and he was the man who they went to if they had any complaints or they wanted anything changing in the village.
Well, in your reporting, did you go to any areas or villages where it wasn't working like that, where a woman actually did have authority and was making a difference as a woman?
Absolutely. Only a kilometre and a half from the village I've just mentioned, there was an extremely impressive female sarpanch who'd done great things in her village. She'd come to power in a reserve seat in 2005.
What is her name?
Her name is Maya Yadav, and she's a 50-year-old mother of two. She had made all sorts of changes in the village in immeasurable sort of ways to the positions of women, to the education of girls, and various other changes that were not gender specific, but nonetheless impressive. And villagers spoke extremely highly of her.
What are the kinds of things that Maya did as a chief or a leader in that village that made a real difference in that region?
I should start by saying that Haryana, which is the state in which her village is located, has actually the worst male-female ratio in India. So nationally, the figure is 933 females to every 1,000 men. In Haryana, it's 861 females to every man.
And why is that?
This is because people are choosing to find out the sex of their fetuses when they're pregnant and then aborting a large number of the girls. This tells us that women in Haryana have a very low status in society. This is reflected in all sorts of ways. Far fewer girls go to school. Dowry payments from the families of brides to bridegrooms to sort of take their daughters off their hands tend to be very high. And so she's worked in all these areas. She campaigns against female feticide. She encourages girls to go to school. And she has discouraged dowries by taking away one of the old rituals in the village, which was the night before the wedding. Everyone would go over to the bride's house to look at what her family was giving to the bridegroom. She's stopped that now. So she says a lot of it's about showing off. Now people can't show off about dowries. The size of dowries has gone down.
And why did she decide to run for chief of the village?
Well, she was a very feisty, well-educated woman. But what was interesting is that when I said, why did you decide to run? She said, because people told me that I should run, because my husband told me that I should stand. And so at first she came to this position with very little confidence. And she said, and other villagers backed this up, that in the 5 years that she'd been in power, she had grown in confidence. And so much so that she's going to stand in elections this, actually next month, when her seat will no longer be reserved because the reservations rotate from state to state and village to village. The chances are she'll stand against a man, but she will stand for power this time round.
And how are the men in the village responding to her leadership?
Well, I went around and asked lots of men, hoping that I would get some chauvinistic response because it would be interesting. And I didn't find any with that response at all. They weren't particularly aware of her gender, to be honest. They just talked about the things that she'd done for them. For example, when she first came to power, she introduced latrines into every single house in the village by negotiating a massive discount with a toilet provider. And that went down very well with everyone. So the men just talk about her job. They don't talk about her gender.
You mentioned there had been some pretty extensive research done on the change having a quota for women in local government has made in India. What are they finding in terms of way of life in rural areas in India? What kind of difference, if any, is it making?
I suppose the most dramatic difference that it's making is that women have been found to spend the money that's directed to them by local and state governments on amenities that matter to women. And the main one is water wells. So if you have a female village leader, she's more likely to provide access to drinking water than a man leader is. And that's because it tends to be the women who collect the water. And the intangible, but still very important, symbolic difference that women make in a village with a woman sarpanch or village chief, the way that women speak about her role is very interesting. They're more interested in what she does and they're more likely to talk to her. And this has been backed up by academic research by some American researchers from MIT who found that the percentage is very small, but since women have been in positions of power, more women in the village have participated in meetings and they're more likely to make complaints. I mean, it's only by 3 percentage points, but in the context of a village in which men hold almost all the power and women have no role, that over time will come to make a big difference.
And if this does pass, I assume this will be a real sea change for Indian politics, a real shift.
I think it will be one of the biggest social and political changes in India since independence.
Mian Ridge is a freelance reporter based in Delhi. Mian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Women in Afghanistan live with strict rules of behavior and cumbersome dress codes. But it's not a new law like the one we just heard about in India that's helping Afghani women reach their potential. It's a reality show. Will Everett reports from Kabul.
It's 5:30 p.m., the time when Afghans all over the country tune in to the evening news on Imruz TV, the country's biggest private TV station. The presenter is a woman of 22. She's dressed in a bright blue dress and a scarf draped modestly over her hair. Her name is Shitara. Until a year ago, she was just another Afghan woman looking for her big break. She found it when she became a contestant on a reality TV show called Afghan Model.
It was time that people in Afghanistan took pride in their beautiful men and women.
Najibullah Kabuli is the founder of Imruz TV and producer of Afghan Model.
When we put out the word, the response was amazing. We got about 4,000 entries from all over the country.
About half of them were women. Despite the initial response, though, many of them dropped out.
The girls got permission from their immediate family, but then word got around to their cousins and uncles who often lived out in the provinces. Many of them said, if you do it, we will kill you.
Shitara had the same experience. She jumped at the chance to compete, and her immediate family was supportive. But when some conservative relatives heard about it, they were outraged.
Sure, there were some people in my family who were against it, but it's my life and my decision. I want to see Afghan models on the same level as models in the rest of the world.
And yet, the show is very much unlike modeling competitions in the rest of the world. As the contestants come out on stage, the men wear muscle shirts and skin-tight jeans. But the women are covered from head to toe in the traditional Afghan clothing of a century ago, with elaborate head coverings and long-sleeved garments covering every inch of skin. Najibullah clearly wants to err on the side of caution, and yet his sponsors are taking no chances.
We couldn't find any sponsors willing to buy commercial time. They were all afraid. So we're paying for all the expenses of the program ourselves.
Najibullah says he's had even more entries this year than last, though he can't cite an exact number. He hopes that as the program grows in popularity, more Afghan companies will take a chance on using Afghan models instead of looking abroad. He says he formerly had only male newscasters at Imruz, but when he saw Shitara's performance, he knew she'd be perfect for TV. So in addition to the roughly $100 in first prize money, he offered her a job. Shitara says it was a dream come true.
Even before auditioning for Afghan Model, I dreamed of being a model. Now I've done it, and it's helped to get me my first job. So I've gone from appearing on TV to working on TV.
She's good at what she does. She says she studies the delivery techniques of the other Afghan news anchors and even watches YouTube videos of Walter Cronkite. But her big dream is to become an international model. She says she can envision herself living and working in New York. I ask her if she'll stick to the Islamic dress code when she gets to New York.
I think wearing a headscarf on stage should be okay. It doesn't cover the whole face.
But as she hurries off to prepare a script, it's clear that she's found a place for herself right here on the evening news. And that's the way it is. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Kabul, Afghanistan.
Women in Bolivia are wrestling for recognition, literally. It happens every Sunday in El Alto, an impoverished city on the Bolivian plains. Crowds flock to wrestling matches in the Coliseum there. But it's not just men taking the knocks. Indigenous women called cholitas, dressed in traditional layered skirts, shawls, and bowler hats, climb into the ring to fight masked men. The women often win. In a man's world, Vera Luz Cortez Hidalgo is a 28-year-old Aymara Indian, a mother of two, and the star of the show.
Mi nombre real es Vera Luz Cortez Hidalgo.
My real name is Vera Luz Cortez Hidalgo. I'm a professional wrestler, and my wrestling pseudonym is Yolanda the Amorous.
My
mom doesn't like that I wrestle. She doesn't want me to do the sport. But she says, okay, even though your dad has forgotten about you, he was a wrestler, and you have it in your blood because you are the firstborn. As a woman, I sometimes have to fight a man, and I know that the man can beat me with strength, but the man is never going to beat me with intelligence. Men said to us that women are only good for the kitchen, or to look after the kids, or to wash clothes, but that's a lie. We're already rising up for our dignity. Enough of them humiliating us. Enough of all the things they say. Yes, we take pride in saying women know how to cook. We know how to be mothers. We know how to work in the house. But now we can also do a sport. We can do what we want if we have the desire. And more than anything, this undertaking is born in us to not be less than a man. One more day of wrestling, another day of festivals, another day in the Coliseum, living the same emotions that people feel, the kids, the applause, that's my nourishment. That applause is nourishment so that Yolanda feels even better.
No hay nadie más que Yolanda.
And there is no one but Yolanda.
That was Vera Luz Cortez Hidalgo in her own words. This piece was produced by Sarah Shariari. Did you see that episode of Seinfeld when all the neighbors in Jerry's building decide to kiss when they see each other? Jerry didn't like it much.
And I'll tell you another thing, Cosmo, Kramer, whatever you want to be called. The kissing thing is over. There's no more kissing, and I don't care what the consequences are.
And consequences there were. Jerry became the building pariah. Well, here's reporter Grant Fuller to tell us about a greeting ritual practiced by the Dogon people of Mali. The Dogon live in a series of small villages dotting cliff tops and plains in the central part of the country. And they've got a greeting routine that one skips at one's peril.
It was the crack of dawn after my first night in a Dogon village. I slung my backpack over my shoulder and I was ready. Let's hit the trail and move on to the next village. But before we could even cross the dirt road, we'd come to a stop. Our Dogon tour guide, Suleiman Goro, just had to say hi to someone. Again. This time it was an old family friend, a woman sitting in her courtyard brushing fresh-picked cotton. I'd seen him do the exact same thing at least a dozen times the day before. the guy greeted everything that moved. It all seemed rather elaborate and unnecessary to me, but it quickly became clear this was essential to daily Dogon life, much more than a simple pleasantry. The rule seems to be that if your eyes meet, you must greet, even if you don't really know each other. Now, when I lived in New York, eye contact with a stranger on the subway usually resulted in an awkward turn of the head. And while strangers might greet each other in small-town America, Dogon villagers take it several steps further, far beyond a simple, "Good morning, how you doing, I'm fine." I decided to ask Suleiman and his friend to repeat the ritual slowly and break it down for me. So, listen closely. Here's what they're actually saying.
Agapo.
Agapo.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
How's your wife?
She's fine.
How are your mom and dad?
Fine.
Okay.
And how are you?
I'm fine.
How are your children?
Fine.
How's your husband?
Fine.
How's your mom?
Fine.
Oh.
Everything's fine.
And how's the work going?
Work is fine.
Well, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, have a nice day.
And there you have it. The routine varies ever so slightly from person to person, but the gist of it stays the same. And what amazed me is that even though they all know the script by heart, the participants seem to be consistently interested in the questions and responses. After a while, I found this tradition actually put a smile on my face. Something about it had a charming effect, and I admired the fact that the exchanges were genuine. Later, I learned from Suleiman that the ritual is so important to the Dogon that anyone failing to do it would be ostracized for committing such a deep insult.
The people didn't consider you again. Yeah, you see, maybe if you want to be strong, you stay together with the people for this town.
In other words, this is really about survival. After all, when you live on the desert's edge, in rock and mud homes in the shadow of a towering cliff face, you need your neighbors. So you can't afford to be a rebel. If you do, if you decide to stop greeting people the right way, you'll become an outcast, shunned. People won't give you the time of day. Out here, a little respect for tradition goes a long way. But lucky for me, the rules don't apply to visitors just passing through.
Seo.
Seo.
Umana Seo.
Seo.
Nyanawa Seo.
Seo. Seo.
That reporter's notebook came to us from Grant Fuller, who visited Mali's Dogon country as a tourist last year. There's a slideshow to go with this story. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Music from Haitian singer Emmeline Michel, coming up on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The treaty banning cluster bombs becomes international law on August 1st. More than 100 countries have signed the treaty. Vietnam is one of a handful of countries that still hasn't signed on, even though as a former war zone, its countryside is littered with unexploded bombs. It's the poor farmers who suffer the consequences, because they scavenge for scrap metal to earn cash. Daisha Eaton reports from Khe San, Vietnam.
On a rainy afternoon, Lee Van Tung sits in the front room of his small concrete home while his wife prepares tea. Tung takes out an X-ray, holds it up to the light, and points out a corn kernel-shaped piece of metal between his ribs.
There's still a piece of metal from the ordnance in my back. The X-ray shows that it's still there, but we don't have the money to remove it.
He's also missing his index finger. But Tung says his wounds are just the price of doing business. Tung is a rice farmer, but he supplements his income by hunting for scrap metal, everything from old tin cans to car parts. Normally, the 49-year-old father of four would be out today doing just that, but the rain makes the trails impassable. Tung says the danger of his job is outweighed by his poverty.
There's no other job to do, so we would have nothing to eat otherwise.
About 3 years ago, Tung says he was out hunting for scrap with his nephew when he detected a big piece of metal on the forest floor.
But under it was a cluster bomb. As we dug, it exploded. I was hospitalized after the accident. It made a hole in my lung, and I still feel pain every time it gets cold.
Although accidents involving explosives are common, Tung and most other men here continue to scavenge for metal anyway. And the bombs are hard to avoid. That's because Kaesan is just outside the former demilitarized zone, which divided the north from the south. It was the site of some of the fiercest fighting of the war. And today the countryside is still littered with explosives. They include landmines, bombs, and what likely injured Tung, cluster munitions, baseball-sized bomblets filled with BB-sized pieces of metal. This is the scrap metal yard where Tung sells his stuff. On this day, a group of men stand in the bed of a truck and throw their scrap onto the ground while others sort it below. In the distance, a rust-colored mound of shards made up of exploded bombs sits in a pile 10 feet high. Bui Ti Hua runs this business. The price of scrap metal has crashed since the global economic downturn, but Hua says that hasn't stopped the scrappers from coming. They do, she says. The families here are so poor that they still have to go out and try to find scrap metal just to afford rice. Hua says that over the years, she's seen several of her neighbors injured in accidents like Tung's. Some people have been hurt by cluster bombs when they plowed a new crop, she says. But scrap collectors have detectors, and when they detect an explosive, they should stop. But Li Van Tung says detectors can't always tell the difference between a car part and a cluster bomb, so it's not a scrapper's skill that determines whether he lives or dies.
It depends on who's lucky and who's not. It's all about fate.
Tung uses his metal detector to show me the spot in his backyard where he buried two explosives for safekeeping. It's beside a patch of greens near the family garden. Tung came across the grenades 5 years ago while he was plowing. He says he called authorities to come take them away, but...
The soldiers said two grenades weren't enough to bother with. They said to call them back if I found more, and then they removed them all at once.
And they've been sitting there ever since. Li Van Tung is one of more than 7,000 Vietnamese who've been injured or killed by unexploded ordnance in Quang Tri province alone. The Vietnamese government is working with international organizations to remove the explosives, but experts say at the rate that it's going, it could take up to 300 years to finish the job. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daisha Eaton in Kaesan, Vietnam.
A couple of weeks ago, a team of explosive experts, funded by an American humanitarian group, finally removed the two grenades from Tung's backyard.
Many rivers to cross, but I can't seem to find my way over. Wondering I am lost as I travel along the white cliffs of Dolores. Yes, I got many rivers to cross.
That's the voice of Emmeline Michel singing Many Rivers to Cross. The Haitian singer, who lives in New York, performed the song during the Hope for Haiti telethon. It was broadcast after the January 12th earthquake. When I last spoke with Emmeline a few years ago, she told me how connected she felt to her homeland. Now she says that feeling has only strengthened since the earthquake. Emmeline Michel joins me now. Emmeline, welcome back to the World Vision Report.
Thank you very much, Peggy. My pleasure. It's always nice to have a conversation with you.
Well, it's good to have you back on the show. And we understand that you had only been back in the United States for less than a month when the earthquake struck in Haiti. And I'm wondering what your response was, how you went about trying to help your friends and family who were still there.
I came back on January 1st, and I was in Haiti the whole month of December with my son. He's 9 years old, and we had a beautiful time, like, where just take me back the moment he came from the airport. Mommy, take me back, because we came back. It was just so cold here in New York. And 12 days exactly after, it just perfect nightmare. It's surreal because it's like maybe it's not happening to you. You're just going to wake up from a moment to another and find yourself. It's just a bad dream or bad. It's just surreal. That's the word.
So you held a few concerts in New York. Who came to those concerts and what were they like?
I had a lot of people from my community. I think it's just they wanted to be together, you know, have a hug and talk about what happened. And do you know so-and-so? Have you heard from your family? It was one very healing place.
You're still engaged in this fundraising effort. You're still doing concerts to raise money for the victims of the earthquake?
Oh, yes. And I'm heading to Haiti on May 10th. You got to keep reminding people that, you know, there's thousands of people that now are living with one leg, one arm, one eye, and just that help is going to be continuous effort to keep supporting Haiti, and you got to keep that consciousness awake.
Will this be the first time you've been back since the earthquake?
Yes, because I had a lot of different commitment since music is my life and I tour a lot. I couldn't really escape a lot of the engagement I had.
I'm sure it'll be quite a shock for you.
I'm getting myself emotionally ready.
Yeah. It won't look like it did when you were there before.
Mm-mm, no.
You know, Emmeline, you frequently sing about your love for Haiti. And I'd like to listen to one of those songs. What would you suggest we listen to that best exemplifies a song that is all about Haiti?
Mwen Pakalageo. Mwen Pakalageo is one of the songs that when you start hearing the words, you think I'm talking about a man. But it's simply a passionate portrayal of whatever happened to Haiti. I will not let my country down. In the sense, I won't turn my back to Haiti, and that's what the song is about.
Mare baguette m'en disparaît. Malouillon télévision. Yo l'on menon kem kasse. Yo palé au mal, zèl m'en pousse.
Is this something you wrote after the earthquake, Emily?
No, before. I realized there is so many hymns of love in all my repertoire.
So the songs you had already written were really pertinent to post-earthquake Haiti. I mean, there were a lot of songs of pain and longing and love for your country and vows to stand by Haiti no matter what it goes through.
Yes, and believe it or not, after the earthquake, I couldn't write nothing.
No, I can believe it. Yeah, I can imagine.
I have tried because I had, should I say, orders. Mm-hmm. I have been working with different beautiful orchestra that are going to be performing on May 28th, and they want me to write. They asked me to write certain songs. There was a chant because when that happened, I couldn't sleep. The whole entire time, I would wake up like, there's right in the middle of my chest something that will not heal. And how do I express to people that are still living there how much I really, really feel for them and how much I want to help? And there's a melody that came out, and we're putting that with the 35 pieces orchestra. But it's a melody that I was chanting to put myself to sleep. And that came out of all the trouble and tumult that I felt in my heart.
Is that a melody you could sing at all for us? Is there any part of it, piece of it, you could sing for us?
Nane o yale, you do the balaba, yale o yale, the balaba, yada ye. You do be a babe, a babe. A de bala bala. Hey, hey. Yale, oh, yale.
manama hey ya le o ya le manama hey udubi marabe babawe manama.
It really does capture what you were describing to me, waking up in the middle of the night with those feelings. What are the words to that song?
I don't know yet. I don't know yet because I think it's song unfold. It's just a complaint and just a certain kind of a sense of yet despair, but you wanna remain confident. Okay. Every ending is a beginning. And the song is going to be probably about that new beginning, you know, this ending that symbolizes a new sun, a new beginning for Haiti.
All right, I want to take a little turn here, Emmeline, to ask you a little bit about music in Haiti. What role has music traditionally played in the life and culture of Haiti?
It's essential. It's practically the core of that culture. I think, like, when I remember how in the countryside, when you wake up in the morning, grandma making coffee and that humming that doesn't even have a word while she's washing the clothes, and there's always singing going on. Music is essential. It's a part, integral part of everyday living for Haitian. I mean, there's always a radio or something going on in their house. You want to hear pure silence. There's always music going on in every house in Haiti.
And that's how you grew up, listening to music every day.
Yes.
Well, yes. Let's listen to another song of yours, one that really highlights the sounds that you've just described of Haiti. What would you suggest?
I would go for banda.
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 Leve matin mande banda. Ou pran tèt mwen kon malade. Ma privé ou depi mdi 4-4. Nan mou pamba pou patate. A son ton drape kata ou fè la joie fè mi kala.
A little bit about this song.
That's one of my favorite because everywhere we play it, we're a non-Haitian speaker, whichever nationality, they always want to come on the stage, and it's associated to a dance.
They want to come up and dance. I bet everybody starts dancing when they hear that.
I love that because
made me want to dance.
I'm glad. I'm glad. That's the idea. The lyric says, "May the sun rise in my heart. Break bad days and our misery and put us together, all together in one dance."
All right, Emmeline, I think I just have one more question for you. You're heading back to Haiti soon for the first time since the quake. What is it you hope to accomplish while you're there?
I'm heading to a young youth orphelina where there's young girls that have lost a leg, and I'm going there to kind of spend a time speaking to them and try to empower them and try to just be a part of something positive. I have requested there won't be no media because it's really a very personal experience. I don't want to do a show. I'm going there, of course, with one guitar for the purpose of being there for these children. But I think they are symbolizing the hope that every Haitian are nourishing in their heart.
Emmeline Michelle, it was great speaking with you again, and we wish you the very best on your trip back to Haiti. I hope it's not just healing for the children that you speak with and sing to, but for yourself as well.
Thank you very much, Peggy. I truly appreciate that.
Shoo, papaya.
Shoo. Emeline Michel is a Haitian singer living in New York City. We'll leave you with some more of our music now. And if you'd like to find out more about Emeline Michel's music or any of the other stories you've heard in today's show, please visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter or become a friend of the show on Facebook. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepard are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, Building a Better World for Children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Vois le vol, les rideaux, bouche frivole sur ma peau. Je ne veux pas voler trop haut. Tant de délire et de rire, je sens que je peux mourir. Quand je plonge dans l'eau immense du plaisir, il pleut, les éclairs fusent. Je prends le feu, je refuse. Je refuse de couler, avec toi je vais flotter. J'aime, j'aime, j'aime. Je...